Good morning, everybody. And we're here today to show you the three-year business plan of Gruppo Piaggio, or the Piaggio Group. So we will see what lies ahead. And in particular, I'd like to thank Paul Betts. There's no need to introduce him. You're all familiar with him since he is one of the leading and most authoritative financial journalists. So the floor is straight away to Paul. I'm here for two reasons. Well, first of all, because I have long-lived experience, so to speak, with Piaggio at the time of the young member of the Agnelli family, and then when Morgan Grenfell, we were all excited at in London after, during several events, and also when Mr. Colaninno bought into the company. And then I really flanked and followed Mr. Colaninno in the fight, so to speak, to acquire Telecom. So it's a pleasure for me just to be back here in such a pleasurable business environment here in Italy. So I don't want to act like Emilio Fede, which is an Italian anchorman. So Mr. Colaninno, you know him. Mr. Galli, you also know him. Then Davide Zanolini is here with us today. He's the newly appointed head of marketing and communication, and I think he formerly worked with Pirelli, if I'm not wrong. And then Francesco Mercanti, who is the head of marketing prodotto, so new introduction. And then Luca Sacchi, head of strategy and strategic innovation. And Miguel Galluzzi, in charge of the Advanced Design Center. The floor is to Mr. Zanolini to start with the meeting. Well, before addressing our business plan, there's a short detour, so to speak. We will try just to connect life with the Harvard University, where Professor Jeffrey Schnapp, who is the faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet Society, is waiting to be joining us. So let's try and set up these connection in order just to have a chat with him. Jeffrey? Hi. Hi. So you don't know, but you're actually addressing quite a large audience. So the floor is now to our chairman, Roberto Colaninno, who would like just to chat with you. I know that in April I will come to Boston and see you and visit you. Yeah, that's true. We are all excited, very excited and hyped. And the idea of starting working with you is really excellent in our view. And therefore, we will be very, very glad to host you and to have you here. So this is the big new thing, which is really the pivot, so to speak, of the new business plan, which we're going to introduce to you. In other words, Piaggio has decided to work together with Jeffrey, but most importantly with Harvard University. So we've decided to work together with them in order to check and see what are the models going forward and to understand the way forward in the area of urban mobility, something which will unfold as a big issue in large metropolitan areas or downtown areas. The issue of mobility in downtown metropolitan areas is really a global issue which is key to the future lifestyle of people, and we're really sure that there will be new ways or new modes of mobility going forward in this area with new products, but not just that, also new clients, new customers. So we have decided, incidentally, we got quite a positive response from Jeffrey and from Harvard University. So we got a positive response from them. They decided to work with us in order to jointly study the matter so as to identify these new forthcoming mobility model and patterns as well as customers. And probably we will see things that we cannot even barely anticipate or foresee today. We will probably be witnessing the onset of new technology. Most likely we'll be seeing also different styles. We will probably also see altogether different customers. So the business plan, which has been put together after these dramatic economic downturn that has affected the entire world, is not meant to be the traditional business plan or a business plan in a business as usual or standard mode, just like manufacturing, selling, and delivering goods. Quite on the contrary, the underpinnings will be innovation in terms of product innovations, human resource innovation, as well as methodologies and processes innovation. Methodologies are important both for the internal life of an enterprise, of a company or a business, and that are equally important to identify new products, methodologies that are important in order to communicate with the with digital science and technology, with customers around the world, and with the existing customers a company has, with its future customers, with markets that will develop and unfold, triggered by phenomena which we can barely start to see today. That to say, concentrations in large metropolitan areas of large numbers of people. So we consider our product as well as other companies' products to become the pivot of these new life and lifestyle. So what best opportunity and what best privilege to work with a person like Jeffrey, whose passion really stems from motorbikes and motorbikes racing, and based also on an extensive IT-based track record and expertise and knowledge developed at Harvard University. We will meet with him in April, and for sure we will work together to find the best modes, the best ways to help Piaggio to pave its corporate way in the next 3 years. It's a new way to conduct a business. It's a new way to cope with future, and it's a new way to share experiences among all those who are involved in managing all these issues. He's now speaking English. Well, first of all, I'd like to greet you from Boston, or more specifically from Cambridge. As our friend Davide Zanolini and Piaggio chairman Colaninno said, the issue of present and future of mobility, it's not just a sheer matter restricted to study and investigation. I've been working and investigating and researching in this area for many years. It's also part of my personal past, because I've been one of the few Californian racer who tested different types of racing Aprilia motorbikes in Laguna Seca and Silt Point racing tracks in California when I was still racing. And therefore, the possibility of combining passion on the R&D side on the other, on the one end, and personal passions on the other hand, especially within context, which really leads us to ponder about how current lifestyles or life conditions pertain to town planning, communication, but not just that. They are really leading us to think about ways to rethink mobility on the wake of new technologies. We can therefore have a sort of crossbreeding among different products, among different mobility forms. So this, in other words, for me is tremendously interesting and attractive air of interest, and we are deeply honored to host Roberto Colaninno and his team in a couple of weeks or so to start and activate a dialogue or an exchange of opinions about what might be or how mobility could evolve going forward. And as he said earlier, The important thing is to have really a bird's eye view. That's to say, we will not limit our efforts and studies to sheer technical solutions, because technical solutions then cannot meet the deepest requirements of needs of human beings. Therefore, it will be a melting of anthropological, sociological, and economic standpoints with more technical slants or points of view, such as engineering-related ones. And that's the novel feature of this new initiative, in my opinion. My team and myself here at Harvard will work here, but we'll be joined also by specialists from the MIT and other U.S. as well as international universities. So I think that we will really succeed to make a dramatic change or to trigger dramatic innovation, far-sweeping innovation, the way of conceiving mobility in the modern era and the modern world. So thank you very much for listening to me. And again, Mr. Colanino, I'll be quite glad to see you in a couple of weeks or so. So don't race too much, apparently, somebody said, because we want you all together and totally uninjured. So you spent the entirety of your life in the metalworking business in the UK. Now we have heard from Mr. Schnapp, so I have a question. Would you have ever expected or foreseen such a kind of humanist turnaround? Now, you're now heading, instead, Mr. Colanino, you're now heading the Piaggio Group. So what's the future you see for the two-wheelers world and your group? Well, it is very difficult, as it is customarily so, to foresee and imagine what future will be like. As far as I'm personally concerned, future is quite a fuzzy thing. It's the fuzzy combination of elements and factors and phenomena that then we must be capable of reorganizing. We must be capable of giving an order to them. We must be in a position to appreciate them and come to a point to understand that that might be pertinent to or useful to for somebody. There are times at which, in order to do so, you need to ponder over a few things first. You must kind of stop for a while, and you must really change your mindset. You must change your point of view, your way of looking at things. You must really change your mind and your brain. And this is not an easy task. This exercise, so to speak, typically forces us to adopt or embrace behaviors and behavioral patterns that are quite different from our daily routines. They also demand the solution of new problems. And most importantly, they demand from us to be sufficiently curious vis-a-vis these new elements. Now, the new business plan of Piaggio really summarizes and contains all these elements. In this aspect, it's a sort of all-encompassing business plan. There are over 10 newly hired people who previously worked in positions in completely different industries. And we want them to help us change our mindset, change our brain, in order to be well-geared and well-poised and ready to take the forthcoming challenges. These people have a previous background in marketing or in digital technology. These are people who have a completely different approach to putting together or building a network. Some of them are coming from media, from the media world, and some others come from strategy, that's to say strategy meant as the tool to identify and single out new products. Now, the big surprise is that together with these people, we have succeeded to arouse the interest or to attract, so to speak, universities such as Harvard or such as the MIT, the mythical Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which have already passed and disseminated their experience in the internet to companies and firms that have adopted a strong focus on technologies and new technologies. Well, we want our technology expertise and knowledge to be pooled with them, and thanks to our cooperation with them, we want to have the elements that will spur and stir a new vision, a future that has to be based on human resources, men and women who are culturally independent, but at the same time capable of exchanging views, of confronting their positions, of comparing their stances, and capable of cooperating in order to find new solutions. They must all be also willing to have a customer-centered approach. Incidentally, we're talking about a customer which is non-existent today. We're talking about customers that will exist in an environment which, again, is starting to exist. And I hope that with these words, I'm not going to scare away any investors. But with all this, to a certain extent, we want to anticipate or act before future unfolds. So to anticipate the future means, when this future becomes a reality, to be already there, already fully equipped to meet the newly arising needs. This is no easy job, as I said at the beginning, nor is it a common task or exercise for Italian companies. All too often, Italian companies are dependent on management patterns and models that are totally unfit to catch up with markets and customers' needs. They're not equipped to meet customers' need in a timely manner with the degree of creativity that maybe is available within these organizations, but it's really crystallized. This has kind of become rusty or backward simply because unused.
So I would like, thanks to the wonderful cooperation we're going to have with the Center for Internet Society at the Internet University, what I would like to happen is to open up a debate with them, an open dialogue with them, so that we can they can help us at Piaggio to really tackle future markets and come to grips with them. And I'm persuaded of this. I'm confident that future markets will demand these things. And future clients and customers will demand answers to these problems, to these questions, to these novelties, to this new way of living that is not existing today. So I could be a dreamer. You may charge me with being a dreamer, but if you're an entrepreneur, you have a right to dream. And if you're an entrepreneur, you have this right, as I said. Maybe one can be wrong in doing so, but I think we have the right to be dreamers. And I really took up the right to be a dreamer and started dreaming. And I want to make sure, I want to check whether this dream of mine can be turned into reality. As you well know, we've been living a number of experiences together, and at times we were tackling dreams. We were things sounded like dreams, and there are people who are dreaming in Italy right now, but they are doing incredible things. So let's use them as examples or benchmarks, and let's dream too. Let's be dreamers for one day, and then for the rest of the year, let's be men, people, human beings who can turn dreams into reality, so that this reality can be turned into business, and this business can flourish, because it anticipates the needs of our customers. But in business, you can dream, but indeed you need money to be a dreamer. And right now, I think Mr. Galli You can tell us about your financial highlights and your strategy. You can share a strategy for the next 4 years. He is the only one who's not allowed to dream in this company, Mr. Galli. Unfortunately, I don't have this habit, and I don't have the capability of being a dreamer. But let's dive into figures. 3 years down the line, from 2014 to 2017, I shan't be boring with this slide, because it tells you that the world GDP, one way or another, even in those areas that have been mostly affected by the crisis, that is to say, Europe, the U.S., maybe and India as well, should be recovering, should be starting a recovery. This is what we hear worldwide from a lot of surveys, and so I won't focus on that. Together with the GDP growth, we should also have a picking up of the two-wheeler market. As you know, the two-wheeler market is a multiplier when it comes to GDP impact. So if you work in the food industry and a GDP going 2% down, your sales can go down 3-4%. In our markets, the decline was much stronger from 2007 to today. Market went down 55%, whilst GDP went down 2 or 3 percentage points. So with the picking up of GDP, our industry should be positively affected. These are the figures we can crunch and comment together in the different geographies. We believe the approach we took was positive, a positive one, but not an aggressive one. Many of the analysts who are here in the room see the situation as more positive, but we wanted to be conservative somehow, feet firmly on the ground. As our chairman said, we cannot dream. We cannot afford to dream as far as figures are concerned. Let's start from the European market. Europe, historically, has been the market, the core market for Piaggio, 85% of our market from 2003 onwards. And then we went to 40% of our market and the rest outside Europe. But Europe remains a core market for us, and it collapsed 54%, as I said, since 2007. However, to this decline was not mirrored in a decline in the demand. It's not that people are driving scooters less than they did in 2005. Drivers are still there. Petrol is even more expensive. Parking is even more expensive. If you want to enter the city centers, you have to pay a tax very often. So there are more and more vehicles. It's up 3 million units. I'm talking about scooters and motorbikes and bikes. So it's not the old business like the mail business being affected, the actual postal service being affected by email. No, this is not the case. The drivers are all there, but with the GDP picking up, we can see a recovery for us as well. What happened to Piaggio within this framework, against this background? Of course, we're still a leader for scooters, but also for bikes. We are still retaining our market share, and it was not trivial as far as scooters are concerned. We started from a 27% market share, and it was not easy to tackle a six-year crisis in a row, 72 months in a row, with declining trends and yet retaining our market share. Asian, Chinese players, Korean players came into play. So it was not a trivial exercise to retain that market share in such market conditions with such competitive pressure, and we're still out there with the same market share, and we are still out there. These are our strengths. And how do we see the market going forward? What did we include in our business plan? To the present day, the European market, some of you foresaw that, because we'll go to them, because indeed there were very good predictors. They said starting from February, the market's going to pick up again. As a matter of fact, January, February, and March are showing a positive trend, up 8% in Europe. Oh, of course, if you can do up 8% in the first 3 months, and then you can have a strategy plan, up 40%. No, our plan is up 20% over a three-year time span. From here to 2017, up 20%. Some of you may say too much, but it's still a market that we see 43% below the performance that we had in 2007. You may say, but yet we're doing plus 8% in just the first few months of the year. Some of you will say it's not enough or it's too little, but that's how we view it. So in the European market, we're talking about Western countries, generally speaking, in the same bracket we also see the U.S. with a very similar behavior to Europe. But what do we see? We want to leverage on our leadership position in the scooter universe in a growing market. So we should be like in a lift, in an elevator that's taking us further and further up if we're good at doing what we've always done at times of crisis. So this is the first driver for our growth. What are we going to do? We're going to focus on what we are very good at doing, scooters, Vespa, MP3, GT, and we can be very good at doing things, and some of our people will tell you how good we are at entering the bike world and doing very well in the bike world. We've already done a lot, but we can do better in terms of CAPEX as well. And within the plan, we want to somehow put them at work and turn them into a value-accretive item. So we want to further improve our positioning in the bikes world. And technology-wise, we deserve that. Style-wise, you saw that in California, we deserve that. So in order to do and achieve that, we have to leverage on intangibles, marketing, communication, on physical assets as well, the network and partner network. We have 10,000 of them helping us on our sales on a day-to-day basis. Second driver for growth, or something we're going to lever on, we want to broaden our customer base worldwide. As you saw, there are countries, there are geographies where we do not yet have a franchise and where we could have a franchise, because otherwise we could be there with a zero investment. Look at the Western countries. LATAM is one of those. 3 million units, it's a difficult market, but we're losing 2,000 units per year because in the past we did not have the right products. We did not have the right bikes and scooters because it's a very special market segment we have there. But starting from March, you'll see that in the quarterly report, we've decided to enter LATAM as well with a low CAPEX level, with a bike we have developed in joint venture with a partner. And starting from March, we'll enter Latin America with that product to try and build on it, to start from importing to CKD to manufacturing units or broader range of products. But we're going to put our foot through the door in a region we have neglected for years and that could generate cash flow at low risk, for the time being at least, I could say so. And another thing that I can add, and we feel confident and willing to further develop and grow. Pietro was the first one to come up with hybrid and electric for two-wheelers. And there's room for growth there. We see it. And there's a will by the group who has already invested in the technology to broaden the customer base for those products as well. To areas where we're not, electric bikes, for instance, could be an example, electric scooters or electric, I don't want to tell you too much about these potential products, but we already have this technology, we can leverage on it, and we can enter some markets with a very low CAPEX impact. And then in Europe, we want to carry on doing what we are doing. We want to be competitive on the cost side, we want to be competitive on the OPEX side, so as to keep costs low. And we managed to achieve these results in Europe by reducing by 100 million euro our SG&As in addition to cost of products, starting from 2009 until today. So from 2009 until today, in a shrinking market, a market going down by 55%, yet we have managed to cut costs by 35%, and that's no trivial exercise, especially in Italy. Think of the fact of how human resources have to be handled in Italy, etc., and labor has to be handled in Italy. And then Asian, it's a major market for us. Scooter are 8.5 million units, so half of the scooters that are sold in the world. And then Vietnam, a market where we are very strong. We entered that market a long time ago. We came up with a premium bracket, with a premium product. bracket that really started generated cash flow over the years thanks to our premium positioning, the premium positioning we have achieved with Vespa in particular. What is happening in those markets is, for instance, the customer base is getting richer, the middle class is growing, so they have a higher and higher disposable income. So we are opening up, there are market segments that are opening up in those areas. Let's look at the Asian market. 5 years ago, it was a flat market, $1,000 scooters, and regardless, no product standing out. But then Piaggio entered with Vespa. Luckily enough, I must say, now there are other players who are copying us. Vietnam, Honda entered with SH. In the short term, they may have been causing some pain to us, but the fact that the middle class is growing, the fact that the market has a higher average ticket, and the fact that Honda, they want to probably earn a lot more money, but on one single product. If we think of now, going forward to 5 years down the line, there'll be market brackets that did not exist 5 years ago. In Vietnam, 5 years ago, there were only simple standard scooters. Now there are 250,000 units that are more than 50 million Vietnamese currency unit. And we, in those markets, we can really compete a lot better than those markets where the average price or average ticket is $1,000. What do we want to do in that area? We want to replicate what we did in Vietnam because we're a leader in the premium bracket of the market. And we are undisputed leaders, so we want to carry on retaining that position, and we want to do more by building another four Vietnam-like countries. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to replicate that in Indonesia, Thailand, or Malaysia. The Indonesians are much richer than Vietnamites, and so these populations are even richer. So helped by other brands that we can factor in, we can really generate or expand our market. And those of you who have joined us in the conference call today know that we have growing numbers in those countries, so we should replicate that to another four Vietnam-like countries from 40,000 Vespa, not 80,000 as we did in the past. So the plan, leveraging on that, could definitely be well unfolded. And then, as we said, we want to increase our customer base. The same bike we are taking to LATAM, we can also take to Asian countries. China is a strange market, not typical. The average ticket is low. Those who ride a bike are poor people, and you cannot go to the city center by bike. But there, too, traffic is increasing. So things could change even overnight. We have a joint venture there, but we also have a fully owned vehicle there. In the past, it was almost impossible to have a joint venture in China. It took longer to have a negotiation with partners than it was to negotiate with customers. Starting from March, we have a new vehicle, fully owned vehicle, and the company's been in place for 1 year, but they were only doing R&D and purchases. But now, thanks to this new vehicle, we can leverage the vehicle to enter the market as well. And this will require a very low capex commitment, but and could help us further and better spread risk and shed risk.
So this could really generate major benefits and advantages. Two-wheelers in Indian market world, for sure this is a very difficult business segment. We did not probably kept our promises. It's a very competitive market, strong concentration among players. And you can have a volume-driven market where, let me rephrase it, we discovered that there is not such a customer bracket who's willing to pay a premium price. But we're working on marketing. We're trying to expand the product range, premium motorbikes, Vespa, and so on and so forth. Therefore, those of you who have concerns over the return on our investment, then my reply to you or my message is don't be worried. I would not be worried because our production plant is up and running, and we're really feeding and covering capacity both through domestic market absorption as well as feedback to other markets, because because we have a way lower prices than we have with our Chinese JV. And over time, and here is my message, we will reap results. It's not yet a cash generating unit. It's still absorbing cash. We still have to allow time for it to grow. So Indian three-wheelers and four-wheelers or light commercial vehicles, as we told you, it was negatively affected strongly so in the past few months. Apparently, there is going to be a recovery soon after the election, so we're not totally negative on that. We have two areas for growth. First of all, exports, which is to be valued as much as the domestic market. Bajaj has invoiced 300,000 units, and we have acquired a 5% market share, which can be scaled up. And in addition to this, we have another growth area, which is penetration in metropolitan areas. We have Bajaj and City Apepax. We have already acquired 11 percentage points in market shares with an additional upside. And then we have the growth opportunities provided by four-wheelers. We have a product, we have a dealer, and basically we can capture part of customer switching from three-wheelers to four-wheelers. So in a nutshell, these are the key messages. We have already covered most of that, but let's go straight to the numbers. From 550,000 pieces to 800,000 vehicles, up 10%, that's the CAGR, which is spread over the, or which is across the four areas, which I've mentioned. We will maintain our market share, and we have a greater growth of motorbikes in LATAM, creation of the new corresponding Vietnamese markets. Then in India, we will push on Vespa in a market which is which has a CAGR of 20%, and then exports and penetration in metropolitan areas. Let's have a look at our net sales. It needs to go from 1.2 billion to 1.7 billion. So for sure, as you can see, this is quite a demanding, challenging business plan. But in addition to what Mr. Colanino said, and to and combining them with what I have explained to you, that might be considered as a conservative number that we might even outperform. Now, these growth numbers or degrees growth rates, so might come from Europe, first of all, might come also from Asia in terms of contribution generated by growth rates, and also by India and Indian two-wheelers. A few words about products. Growth CAGR 10% again, which is probably distributed with a stronger focus on motorbikes, which are expected to be up 17%. We don't just have these outstandingly good motorbikes, but also smaller ones that should be conducive to a greater penetration in the Americas as well as in Asian areas. A few words about financial. We presented our EBITDA 12.1%, 147 million euro. We presented it during our conference call, and then we have an expected growth of 100 million euro, broken down as follows. 65 million is basically contributed by sheer net sale growth. So 65 million will be generated by growth in our total sales, then 10 million will be obtained by leveraging on artificially prices kept at high levels. And let me say that we kept a flat gross margin with strongly declining sales, so which means that as soon as there is a pickup in sales, we can extract scale economies as well as efficiency gains. Last but not least, OPEX up to, but although not proportionally to the expected proportionate growth of net growth, so contributing approximately 30 million euro. Altogether, that adds up to an EBITDA of 250 million euro, accounting to 14% as percentage-wise, which is basically the incidence which we had with the lower turnovers in the region of 1.5 billion. So if you can boost your turnover, you can have a higher EBITDA. A few words about our net income. This year, we had an adjusted net income of 18 million euro. We expect to receive approximately 100 million euro from our EBITDA, then there will be a change in DNA because of the investments we made contributing approximately 10 million euro, and last but not least, taxes that are in the region of 40%, so 40 million euro, and therefore to end our business plan with a net profit of approximately 70 million, which is basically 4%, or which before our last one, net financial position, we start from 475 million of NFP in at year-end 2013. Over the business plan, we expect to have 575 million euro generated by operating cash flow, then approximately working capital contributing 20 million euro. Since we basically are a negative working capital company, this is something which can be easily outperformed. However, we wanted just to signal that number to be conservative. And then 400 million euro, that's CapEx for to fund new products, certain industrial development projects, and approximately 120 million euro in change in equity that might be include buyback of shares, dividend payments, to achieve approximately 400 million euro, that would be the expected NFP at the end of the business plan. CapEx in the region of 100 million euro, what do we mean? Well, 100 million euro yearly, what does that imply? It simply means to go back to a CapEx level which is slightly above the level which Piaggio has historically been holding before building factories. We currently have the factories, we have the assets across the world, and we have built them either to conquer local markets or simply because of buyback of SPVs. So the 400 million should be used to get new products and also to tap opportunities that might come up around the world on markets. That's the end of my presentation, and I'll give the floor back to you. So, thank you very much. I'd like to give the floor to Zanolini, Davide Zanolini, to ask him to go back to what was covered by Roberto Colaninno earlier in the presentation, that's to say the strategic view, the ambition to have a makeover, or better to say a turnaround in terms of vision and also approach on the part of your team. Thank you very much. Let me say one thing right away. I am very, very glad to be here today, and I'm very glad to take up this challenge that was offered to me 5 months ago by the chairman. Why am I saying this? Well, first of all, because there is a clear-cut vision. Also, because there is an extremely concrete, material, real project, and also because there are dreams. The combination of these three elements is like a magical alchemy, which really ultimately led me to take up this challenge. As we have heard, there are men who dream things that already are there and asking why, and there are people instead dreaming on things that are not simply there and asking why these things are not there. So I belong to the latter bracket of people, like Mr. Colaninno, so that's why I was really glad to take this very flattering challenge. In order to better explain what...
Io mi riaggancio.
Well, I'd like to tie back in with the last words uttered in the video. And here it is on a slide. We don't just want to just move people, but we want to change the way people move, which means that we don't want to limit ourselves to make products, but we also want to create experiences. Our business is the business of creating experiences. It's not purely manufacturing. So our ambition is that to become specialists in mobility going forward through our products and through the experiences generated by our products. Now, very briefly, we would like to walk you through our vision and the marketing actions that have already Some of them have already been rolled out. So our number one goal is that of building value around the premium positioning of our brands. Now here there are two keywords, premium and value. Premium does not necessarily mean to be the most expensive one or the best looking from an aesthetic standpoint. Premium means to be the best or the most relevant technology-wise, quality-wise to our customers, the most relevant when it comes to help them change their lives. And then value, well, value for the company for sure, but value across the chain. We want to create something where we can hit that magical common ground where you have a company which grows, its dealers makes money, and whose customers are happy with the products. So all the three steps in the value chain, which makes our products relevant and important. Secondly, we want to have a customer-centered approach to what we do and what we conceive. We're very lucky in that we have products that meet two kinds of needs of our customers. One is their needs and the other one is their passions, and there are not so many products meeting both. And we have several products which instead can do both. So we want to focus our thoughts and efforts around these two classes of needs to identify our customers, recognize their needs and passions, and find the best way to meet both of them. How do we plan to achieve all this? Well, first of all, we want to create an extremely strong premium customer experience, which does not finish when the purchase is made at the dealer's site. That is to say, we want to start well before he steps into the dealer, the dealer's site, and which becomes even stronger when it walks out. Really binding, creating a binding relationship, which means to be part of a community, part of an experience, part of an interaction, of receiving updates, of having a product offering based on merchandising as well. So creating loyalty, something which will extend and expand our direct relationship with customers. Our approach will be mainly based on a few elements, especially at the very beginning. First of all, we want to have an extremely global and extremely consistent approach. Why global? Well, we have to expand our approach. The wider the audience we can reach, and the stronger our brand recognitions. We want our Vietnamese customer to recognize also the same experience, the same products everywhere in the world when he or she sees our products. And the same goes for London customers, which we have. If he or she travels to Shanghai, he should find exactly the same products and find them equally familiar. So we want to be as consistent and as global as possible.
And then we want to do so by giving each and every one of our brand a specific role, attaching a specific role. We have a fantastic set of assets. We have wonderful brands known all over the world, and each of these brands really meets a specific need and covers a specific market bracket. I don't think there are any other players who can be as complex and as extensive as far as the range is concerned, the product range is concerned. Think of how our brands are positioned. Think of Piaggio, for instance. Piaggio is the urban mobility product, and it's commuting from A to B in the best, smartest, most efficient way. It's what we call the smart connection provider. Think of Vespa. Vespa, it's the icon product throughout the world. It's an icon for Italian style. It's what we call the urban chic streetwear. Why streetwear? Because we are dressing up streets and We're dressing up streets with something Italian, something stylish, beautiful, and chic. And Gilera instead is sportswear. It's a very unconventional way, a much smarter way to wear something on the road. And then we have Moto Guzzi. Moto Guzzi to us is the power of pride. Power meaning the very power, the strength, the power our engines release. And it's the power that's embodied by the physical presence of our bikes and the pride of owning such a unique, one-of-a-kind object that really made the history, was a milestone in the history of bike and bike racing. We have a platform with an hashtag, hashtag BA Racer, which doesn't mean we are really telling young people to race their cars throughout. Be a racer means switching on your Aprilia bike and really feeling you are riding technology, riding adrenaline as if being in a race. Marco Melandri is breathing the same adrenaline. This is Be a Racer, the Be a Racer platform, and this is what we are building Aprilia's technology on. And then we have pure fun for everyone. And this is our set of assets. It's not overlapping brands, but rather having them together to have a range that as complete and unparalleled as nobody can have or boast in the market. These are the three main actions we want to engage in. Global communication, we want to provide an innovative retail concept, and we want to provide a full digital experience. Global communication. We created a branding and advertising department within the marketing function, and it's strongly focused on leveraging on our brands. And I have two young talents who followed me, and they were so brave as to follow me from Pirelli, Francesca Brandimora and Marco D'Acunzo, and with them we are building up our global communication strategy for Piaggio. It's the strategy that really unfolds into the future, and we had to start that from Vespa. That was a must. And Vespa is a brand that was born as a social brand. Think that in 1950, Vespa used to tell Italy that was still very much walking and was saying, get a Vespa, Vespizzati. Vespizzatevi. I mean, get a Vespa and start riding it. It's not translatable into English, unfortunately. And then in 1969 and the beginning of the 70s, they were talking to Italy, and if you have a Vespa, you eat apples. If you don't have a Vespa, you don't. And most people in Italy at the time wondered what that meant, but Vespa was further ahead, and they were talking a language that was already into the future, and we think Vespa deserves that type of communication. It's a global type of communication that's not just telling you we have a wonderful product in different levels of power, sizes, magnitudes, in different colors. We just wanted to tell the Vespa story in a different way, but throughout the world. So we came up with a global campaign. It's unconventional, and in order to come up with this campaign, we contact BBH, the most creative advertising agency, and they're based in London, and with them we And communication on its own is useless. Our clients, our customers, we have to meet them, we have to persuade them, we really have to pamper them through a purchase experience that's one of a kind. We have the ambition to come up with premium products. Buying a bike very often is not a premium experience. Let's not hide behind a finger. It's not just bikes we manufacture, but also those from our peers, from our competitors. It's enough to look at the dealers that you have around and the way you are welcomed when you enter a dealer premise. What we want to do is come up with a new retail concept. We are already working on it, And in order to do so, we've called a person, that's Mr. Daniele Pina from the Fiat Chrysler Group, and he's really helping us out with a very different point of view from ours, mindset from ours, and he's helping us build this new idea. Because we want to have the same dealers, same dealerships, offering the same purchase experience throughout the world. We have 4,500 points of sales worldwide. Within 4 or 5 years, we want them to be consistent. We want them to be strongly characterized with a visual identity that's consistent and that provides a consistent purchasing experience, because we're dealing with global customers and buyers, so they have to find the same approach wherever they go. And how do we achieve that? We achieve that through a model we have now been working on. It's going to be a highly versatile model. It's going to be modular. It can be applied to a 50 square meter point of sale, to a 1,200 meter square meter point of sale. You know, it has to be always on. Something will always be taking place, happening, something that's related to the sale of a bike, or that's related to entertainment, that's related to something digital happening there. We want physical to be connected with the digital component. We want something that's focused and designed for bikers, but not only for bikers. We want non-bikers to be able to find something they can buy there or do there or find a focal point there and maybe talk them into becoming bikers. We want to stand out from whatever is ordinary. Whatever is ordinary and you normally find in bike dealers throughout the world. And we want to be extraordinary, one of a kind. And this is going to be the very core of our distribution strategy going forward. And then one last point we would like to make. Professor Schnapp was mentioning that at the beginning, digital is somehow affecting our lives, is changing our lives. And 57% of people are make a decision, a purchasing decision, before actually physically interacting with a salesperson, and they do so through digital media. And we want to have a full integration of our digital platforms. Digital platforms to us is not just what we do on the web. Digital platform is what means at the dealers as well. It's going to be digitized. And what happens with our products, that will be digitized too going forward. So a full digital integration of product, point of sale, and customer web-based customer experience, so that we have a closed loop, positive loop, and we have a constant ongoing dialogue with our buyers, consumers. We want to fully leverage on a CRM. I have a food industry background, and knowing exactly the name, first and last name and address of your customer is a huge asset. You don't have to search for it and chase it. We have that in our database, and we have to start using it at best. We are generating a CRM platform, and we were lucky enough to have Chiara Guzzoli working with us. He's from Danone, and she's the one who developed CRM within Danone. So she's going to give us a big hand. She's going to help us a lot in developing this technology. And then we are also developing our own proprietary technologies that will enable us to further monitor, analyze, and foresee, forecast consumer behaviors. This, in a nutshell, is what we mean by digitization. This is our marketing manifesto. I'm not going to read it out because it's very long. I'm going to walk you through it.
E con questo avrei finito.
And that's it as far as I'm concerned. What would be... they're talking about a Vespa calendar. It's going to be a heavy investment, however. And it's all very well, it's all very nice, but these marketing dreams, they do not work unless you have products underlying that. So maybe you can tell us about the products, and Mr. Mercanti is going to share with us something more about the products. Very well, so we heard a lot of very interesting words. We heard the word future, new customers, new needs, emotions, new functions, and we also heard the word new market, new geographies, if you wish. So it is our responsibility. It's the product function that has to turn that into physical facts, that is to say, products that can meet customer needs and really convey a sense of value that is then translated into the fact that a customer will pick them over other products. In addition to the guidelines to our product portfolio, let me first of all give you a short overview of the large sea we're going to be swimming in, because this is one of the main messages, very important messages, that we wish to convey, the takeaways for you somehow, concerning the two-wheeler world. We're talking about a market that is worth 50 million vehicles, units. That is to say, it's a huge area where you can find customers, where you can find markets, geographies, product offering that has to be customized to meet different needs. There are many countries, you see, that volume-wise are the upper hand, have a lion's share, so to say. But if you look at the value, there are differences here, and somehow this is going to help us understand different behaviors, underlying behaviors. Think of Western countries. Western countries, or developed countries, so to say, account for 5% of total volumes, but in terms of value, they account for more than 30%. So it's different universes that have different features, and you have to be aware of them. The two-wheeler market is divided into three main brackets or categories. We are interested in the green and the red part, the motorcycle, the bike, and the scooter side that account for the largest part of the market, 25 million of bikes and almost 15 million unit of scooters that are sold worldwide. If you look at values, scooter market volume, here again, Gabriel Galli was talking about four Vietnam-like countries, or the so-called Asian countries, where Vietnam has a big role, but there are other markets that, such as Vietnam, have a very strong growth potential for premium brackets or segments. If we look at that in value terms, you see the same ratios, more or less, but sizable is the growth we have in Europe, which accounts for about 1.7 billion. Apologizes the speaker. And look at the global motorcycle market. In excess of 25 million vehicles, China does play a role, but even more so if we look at developed markets, Asian developed countries such as Japan, Australia, North America, and Europe account for a market share that's moving according to different rationales somehow, and that has a specific appeal to us. If we look at the mean values by area, we talked about the a growing average ticket before, but let's see how it can be broken down. So Western countries, which have a very high mean average ticket, but there are also emerging markets that are growing, where you have a growing average ticket. And, of course, we are talking about much cheaper prices here, but 200,000, for instance, vehicles in Vietnam that are sold for in excess of 50 million local currency. Today, as we said, we experience a growth of the average ticket, both for scooters and motorcycles. Of course, there's the volume effect that makes the average fall, but if you factor in Asian developed countries, the average ticket there too starts to be appealing for us, and you have nice products that start featuring prices that could be very interesting and appealing to us.
Having said this, we need a strategy to grow. We said that we want to grow considerably our volumes as well as our products. So our product strategy must really foster this growth. And in order to do so, we have to expand our product offering in order to grow in certain markets and to strengthen our position in others. Let's start with scooters. So we've tried, first of all, to identify the strategy to be adopted in the Western countries vis-a-vis that adopted in emerging countries. Well, in Western countries, we are the leading player, and we have really a tremendous edge over followers in the scooter business segments with market shares that are twice as much or twice as big our competitors. So there the approach is to consolidate, to see that, which means to better cover different business segments. We have quite a good footprint, but there are certain market segments where we're not present or where our presence is not optimal. So we will cover all the most relevant market segments. I've said that we want to have a broad range. We will maintain the existing product range, but being a market leader and consistent with what we did in the past, we want to manage our leadership position, that's to say, through innovation, developing the four new countries, such as the MP3. So find new product concepts that can be considered as crossovers. In the emerging markets, the strategy is quite different, the aim being to develop. We have to develop markets. So the building blocks of this strategy are leveraging the Vespa brand. Vespa is really our ambassador, so to speak, throughout the world. It's the element that really paves the new route for us in order to attack premium market segments. These vehicles have features that are really specific to each market, but they are increasingly, although they are increasingly global in the sense that they can be sold everywhere in the world, however, we want to maintain specific products or develop specific products for the specific needs of these emerging markets. In addition to this, we will like to have a focus on developing very specific products for the Asian market. We mentioned our cooperation with Harvard University. We spoke about the future, and there's really a big issue which is going to be dealt with later by the other speakers, and that's smart mobility. Being a leading player in this industry, we really have the task and the duty to come up with the new innovative solutions through vehicles that should provide a greater efficiency of our power units. It should also be related to the so-called electronic control systems and connectivity systems, the digital connectivity systems of our vehicles. So very briefly, that's what I have to say about scooters. Let's have a look at motorbikes. Here there is an even greater and stronger discontinuity because to a certain extent motorcycles do not see Piaggio as holding the leadership position. So we've got to grow. In the Western countries, what is our goal in the Western countries? Well, we want to go both through Moto Guzzi and Aprilia by leveraging the high displacement existing product range with obviously different editions and versions. But I'm talking about the California product family or certain classes or families for Moto Guzzi. I'm talking about the 750 class. And with Aprilia, instead, we want to provide sports and high-tech vehicles with the displacements above 900 cc's. And you all know the names of the products I'm referring to and which really are members of this family. This is not enough, though. In addition to have these growth goals, we want to monitor newly emerging needs calling for different types of vehicles. So as a result of this, we want to penetrate the segments. As far as Moto Guzzi is concerned, well, that's still above 1,000cc, but we're really moving from the kind of vintage classical type of motorbikes to a type of high-end or touring sport tourer segments. With Aprilia, we want to penetrate another very promising business segment, which is that of so-called mid-sized displacement, that's to say 406 to 600, or small displacement, or low displacement, 125 to 250cc. Please bear in mind that whenever we talk about emerging, please bear in mind that Western countries will represent the entry level of the market, and they will instead be good products for consumers in emerging countries, which instead will consider them as premium products. Obviously, we want to keep our maintenance in motorcycles and small bikes. Well, emerging markets, when we're talking about motorcycles, we're talking about Asian 5 in Brazil. We want for sure to enter and penetrate certain markets according to their respective realities, filling the so-called motor luxury niche. That's to say, we're talking about 1,200 cc's. With the whole range or with the best products or the fittest products in the 750cc family. We also want to penetrate the premium segments with the vehicles with displacements 400 to 600. So clearly, this kind of strategy combines both product decision, product projects, new products, and new industrial strategies, because as it was already the case with scooters, if you want to penetrate these markets, you have to consider the various implications in terms of manufacturing and assembling activities. As for Latin America and other Asia, as to the top mainstream, we're talking about the 125 to 250 range. That's a small bike of Aprilia. They could provide a potential upside. We mentioned the TX and STX, which we have started to introduce in Latin, but we could use them in also to enter Africa. So by evolving, by seeing the growth and the development of these products, we might even use them as a stepping stone to other markets. Having said this, let's then move to the third very important pillar in our strategy, which is represented by emerging markets. Well, there our goal is that of growing. We want to grow there because we believe that for the group there's quite a tremendous upside also in these geographies. What do we plan to do? Well, for sure, we want to leverage again on the APEC concept, product concepts, especially in emerging markets. And the APEC concept and the three-wheeler concept is still has quite an untapped potential. It can simply combine simplicity, product cost, management cost at a very, very low level with a load factor, which really is utmost. So we want to leverage on this, but we also want to leverage on the APE product family, which has been recently completed with the introduction of the APE CT model. Those of you who are familiar with it know that it's basically the basis for taxi cabs or a cab bike in emerging markets. So we will leverage on these both in countries where we are emerging players such as India or in other markets mentioned by Mr. Galli. We will go on with an ongoing development strategy. That is to say, we will renew our product range on an ongoing basis. Then we will also develop new four-wheelers ranging from 0.51 to 1.5 tons segments. And they are probably the fastest growing market segments, and that run parallel to the business segments of three-wheelers, therefore generating synergies, cross-selling to customers we already have. Now, all these combined with quite an extensive engine range, which has been conceived in order to leverage the whole range of alternative fuels, such as petrol, gasoline, liquefied gas, and compressed natural gas. That's for the emerging markets, but when it comes to Western countries, we have multiple actions. So we mentioned our project with Harvard University. We spoke about smart mobility. We spoke about mobility in metropolitan areas. So for sure, there will be a new mobility in terms of moving passengers. That's to say, vehicles such as the MP3 or other three-wheelers, but we believe, and let me digress, that throughout the business plan which we have presented, this sector will be just studied. But we have also to devote our attention to the movement of goods. So mobility will change in terms of people's mobility, but also in terms of moving goods, moving freight, so to speak. So we will develop our existing Porter product range, which and we will do that in compliance with the new Euro 6 standards. We will also develop product concepts that somehow stem from our ability to look ahead of us, trying therefore to anticipate where the future will lead us. Paul, well, I'd like to ask you a question, because you have also the head of Aprilia Racing department. So my question is, will racing still be important for the group, or just be like a passion or a pleasurable thing? Well, we have a motorbike here flanking side by side with the Vespa, and that's an expression of the twofold soul and excellences within the group. Vespa is really the queen of the city, as Davide Zanoni said earlier, but sports motorbike and all that relates to motorbike racings are one of the key fundamental assets owned by the group. We have a brand ambassador such as Aprilia, and that will be the basis for its future, because it's a future that will unfold worldwide with quite an extensive range of products. Therefore, racing is really key in order to restate the excellence of these brands and its leadership position. However, for us, racing has always represented a tool for growing our corporate culture and the motorbiking culture as a way to test and innovate. And I think that in the past, this really led us to achieve quite outstanding technological results well ahead of other players. We had a first SW4 and others. They really were triggers, or they were technological breakthroughs. We were the first ones to introduce very technologically advanced systems and to adopt them to a motorbike. And today we have a whole range of these technologically advanced systems that have been adopted first by us, and obviously other players had to follow suit. This know-how is currently available not just for such advanced motorbikes, but also for scooters. We have traction control or electronic control systems also installed with our scooters, and going forward we will have even more sophisticated digital control system. So these are the two big spenders of the company. So with 100 million yearly, Mr. Galli, do you think you can do all this plus have a CAGR of 10%? Well, my reply is yes, definitely yes. Let me share a couple of concepts with you. First of all, we are spending we're spending to build factories and plants, and we did that with the peak that you saw between 2011 and 2012. So now we have a production asset base, which really allows us to directly serve certain markets and instead to meet the demand from other countries with the products that are made at a lower cost. So 880 million new vehicles that we have included in our plan, they don't call for any additional capex on manufacturing plants. Now, the second concept is that to expand our addressable customer base in order to better leverage on what we have.
So in some areas that are still up for growth, they'll be at zero cost in the top five Asian countries, and in Latin America, we can enter with new products with almost zero capex. So we're talking about not just selling, for instance, more Moto Guzzi products or more Aprilia products in the U.S. So it's totally reasonable from a capex viewpoint, not just for the existing products, but also to start and embark in all the projects the chairman was mentioning. Innovation, of course, focusing on customers, electronic systems, and maybe just crunching figures did not convey the right message, but we want to focus on that too. Mr. Sacchi now, in charge of strategic innovation, and we start from this question. What is it? What does smart mobility mean? Above and beyond being a brand for Mercedes-Benz, brand name. No, smart mobility is the very reason why I joined Piaggio, first of all. Then, of course, I found wonderful human resources there. But smart mobility was a missing link for a very magic moment. Piaggio is going through this very magic moment. There's a tension on the one hand, there's the environment and mobility in cities. So historically, there's a real turnaround taking place. People have to move about, and that poses a challenge. And at the same time, there are some iconic components as far as brands are concerned and the emotions that want to be transferred. So on the one hand, the product has to be functional to serve a function, but at the same time, it has to be an icon and reflect an idea and an icon. So it's not just a product range, but a philosophy that's underlying this. What does smart mobility mean? So we have mobility indeed. So you have to move around. You have to go from point A to point B in the smartest possible way, in the most efficient possible way. And having said that, the situation is ever-changing in cities, so people need to move around. And a few years ago, they had one vehicle, and you had to do everything with it. Today, we have a number of options before us, and we have these options to get from point A to B in a shorter time, to be leaner in our solutions. And smart mobility means leveraging the options that are available as far as moving around is concerned. It's a system that's interacting with the urban system. So it means being able to adapt to the need to move around the city. So it means I can use different vehicles on my journey, for instance, from home to work. And Piaggio, as a market leader, has to really have a grasp of what is happening in the market or in the cities and provide solutions. Because today, the mere idea of products and services is an obsolete concept. Products and services are more and more integrated. It's tangible and intangible assets merging, coming together, so digital solutions are being provided more and more, and they provide more opportunities to consumers. So smart mobility is one of these. It's a combination of opportunities, and digital really enables us to better manage these options and better manage our vehicles. I had prepared a small presentation, just a few slides, but it's a way to tell you about how we are going to approach this. Davide and myself joined Piaggio at the very same day, and so we've been with Piaggio on a very short journey so far, but it's a matter of having the right approach when starting something new, when approaching innovation. And innovation is not just about making something new. That may be irrelevant, may be a beautiful exercise for a research center, but it's meaningless in itself per se, but instead, if we focus on customers and what they need, we innovate by generating something that they need, that meets their needs. We talk about different products. Think of Apple. Apple presented Newton technically by understanding and anticipating customer needs. So innovation can be broken down into a number of factors, and there are four different types of innovation. The first one is the incremental innovation. That's not the not-so-sexy one, the less magical one. There are limited changes to existing products, but this is the very sap of the company, the very core of the company. So somehow we have to keep on improving what we are already good at doing. So it's incremental steps forward by improving services, by improving product features. It's my business, and this is what I'm going to be very good at. And then, of course, there's a breakthrough kind of innovation. You really, it's a turnaround. You break consolidated schemes and setups. So there's technical innovation, breaking the rules of the game, breaking the rules of the market. And then you have disruptive innovation. It's a marketing type of innovation where you change, again, the rules of the games, the rules of the game, but as far as business models are concerned, as far as market approach is concerned. And then last but not least, we're all trying to engage in that, and unfortunately we cannot always succeed. It's the game changer type of innovation. You really change the very market. You change the way in which people think and behave. And these are the type of innovation that are one of a kind. They only happen one-off. They couldn't be sustainable if they were to take place on an ongoing basis. And what Pietro wants to do here right away is to touch upon each and every one of these types of innovation. We want to tap for each and every one of them. Because all of these types of innovation, it's not just having beautiful ideas, coming up with beautiful novelties. Innovation means being consistent in understanding what is worth or not worth engaging through your pathway to the future. And then consumers and innovation. So companies are about people. They start and end with people. It's people who generate innovation or stir you to generate innovation. And consumers, if you ask them what they want, what would they want to have? What they do is they tell you about what they already know. They say, we want a more evolved version of what they already know. But this is not what we're aiming for. The industry we are moving in, we are acting in, is very special. We have very long product development and service development times. So we always have to be ahead of the market. Our time to market is very long. So it's not enough to understand what the consumer wants today, because they will tell us what they already know, but a bit more improved or more advanced. We want to know what their desires are, and we want to be able to turn them into practice. We have to really observe people and to see what their frustrations are. And looking at their frustrations, you come up with a lot of very interesting inspirations or food for thought, so to say. And then you, in addition to consumers, you have the backdrop, you have the so-called context. When we talked about smart mobility, you cannot talk about smart mobility unless you also mention smart cities. And cities are living entities. You interact with them the way you relate to traffic. The way you get from point A to point B somehow is affected by that. So my offering has to somehow be ever-changing and meeting that ever-changing backdrop or scenario. And then I put in technology. Technology is a consequence, is down the line. And engineers and technicians have to be asked the right questions. With my team, what we are trying to come up, and from what we saw at Harvard, is to come up with the right questions to those who actually engage in development activities. And you have to somehow guide the company, address them, and route them in the right direction. And then, of course, last buzzword, last but not least, it's business. Business means if you want to be innovative, you have to come up with products that matter somehow, and we have to make sure the company is investing in something that's meaningful and useful. Let's have a look at some areas we are already working on as macro areas. First of all, sustainability and smart cities. These are two main areas that could be, they're not identical, but they're walking hand in hand, if you wish. And then electric and hybrid vehicles, e-bike to eco-performance. E-bikes, of course, electric bikes, but there's a whole chunk of amusement, enjoyment in moving around with alternative vehicles. We want the same passion to be put into vehicles that are also very functional, and that would be wonderful because it would mean harmonizing different worlds, having them come together, and then new segments for new mobility, and then alternatively powered vehicles, different configurations. How do we relate to intermodal transportation? How do we relate to bike sharing, vehicle sharing, those who use a car rather than train? So we want to be really at the very center of action. And then, of course, technical development versus more conventional conventional technologies like zero shift, for instance, so as to have further improvements and vehicles that are more and more energy efficient as well. And then enhanced experience as far as connectivity is concerned. My connection, the fact of being connected. On the one hand, we mentioned PMP, Piaggio Multimedia Platform, where you have a pad that really tells you how our PMP is evolving and what it will look like in the future. And then the relationship between the vehicle communicating with the smartphone through or via apps. You can talk to the surrounding environment and you can talk to the user always through the vehicle. I'll be able to switch on my vehicle without having to use the key. All I'll have to do is enter a code if I'm next near the vehicle, and I can switch it on without using a key, for instance. It's a keyless tech. There'll be a wealth of info that will be made available for the purpose of technology and innovation. And then CRM, we mentioned that before, and then the world of wearable technology. Unlike cars that take up a lot of space, the pilot, the driver, if you drive a car, the car is bigger than you are, whilst if you drive a bike, you're almost bigger than the actual vehicle. So here again, lots of opportunities to be tapped from, and then vehicle to cloud communications. The vehicle can interact with the surrounding environment. I have to go from A to B in the most efficient possible way, and the vehicle and myself have to know what is taking place, what is happening in that environment at that very moment. So we came up with three-wheelers as well. So far we have two vehicles that really meet that need, and they're very similar to one another. You can then come up with many more solutions. The three-wheelers meet the need. That is to say, it's a safety feature. Drivers are afraid of falling off a bike or a two-wheeler. So the three-wheeler somehow meets the need for greater safety. But we can go further on. And then active and passive onboard technology, smart solution for weather and impact protection, iCall in case of accidents. The vehicle itself triggers a message in case of accident. And then real-time vehicle diagnostics. You can know what happens to the vehicle in real time. And then, as I said before, active and passive onboard technology, again, for safety purposes. And then a new asset, a standalone asset. It's the new domains of research. How can we define that? How can we understand the evolving needs? On the one hand, we have to developed an even more user-centered process. And then we want to leverage on new technologies and channels to improve customer understanding, CRM, eCRM, PMP, retail tools, to better understand consumer needs, and then foster open innovation and co-generation. You want to really be contaminated by counterparties that apparently have nothing to do with this industry. So you are contaminated by people who have different ideas, different visions from what you have. And then, as we said at the beginning, so we're looping back to the beginning, you can develop collaborations with other research centers and institutions that can be very inspiring in our day-to-day work. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, Mr. Galluzzi, last but not least, of course, and the Piaggio Group opened an advanced design center in Pasadena, California. And why so far away from Italy?
Well, I want to sit here so I can take a different view on the world. So first of all, let's have a look at our video. Very, very few words, but very tangible things, please. Well, getting back to your question, why in Pasadena? Well, let me share a short story with you. We are based at this store, site, which is the basis for Barnes & Noble, which is a large chain selling books everywhere across the country, and therefore all physical bookstores are closing down. And Pasadena is a small center, it's a small town, but that's located in California. And therefore, going forward, it will shed the light about what will happen going forward. And the Fiat electric 500 will be sold there. There are a large number of commuters between LA and Pasadena. There are people who have come here after 20 years, and they simply said, that looks like China because of all the people with slanted eyes, but it's just a mix, a melting pot of people from different cultures creating new needs for mobility. And therefore, that's why Pasadena is really an unparalleled vantage point. Well, replying to your question, you probably was asked, what are you doing? Well, we're simply watching from the window because it allows us just to take small signals such as people riding bicycles in LA, which was unheard of. And now they really have to ride bikes zigzagging among cars. Why? Because mobility simply changed things. Okay, thank you very much. I think that the chairman left us and left the room, but I think now is time for a Q&A, and that's the time for you just to be the moderator. So we have already seen the financials as well as the products of Piaggio Group as well as new trends. We have 100 people sitting here in the audience today. Each and every of them has a different question or area of interest, so the floor is to you. What would you like to know? So we can officially open our Q&A session. Thank you, Monica Bosio with Banca IMI. I'd like to start with the business plan. I think it's a reasonable business plan. You have set targets for 2017. We are in 2014. The market consensus gives an EBITDA in the region of 170 million euro, net revenues slightly below 1.3 billion. So here is my question. How do you feel vis-a-vis these targets? Do you feel comfortable about them? Do you think they are achievable? Or since the European market has posted a plus 8%, that's a growth rate recorded at the end of the first 3 months, what you have indicated as a business plan target might be just a floor. What's the number of newly registered vehicles at the end of March? At least as far as Italy is concerned. Then I have a question on the development of a premium strategy, which is for sure based on Vespa and Guzzi and on the concept of premium products. Have you set yourself a target between now and 2017 in terms of volumes for Vespa and Guzzi? Third and final question. I've seen that there's a strong push towards the network of towards the dealers' networks, and there's a strong push on your marketing activities. How much do you plan to spend in that area between now and the end of the plan? Well, we will take your questions, maybe availing ourselves of the contribution of other people. Well, the consensus at 1.370 million, that's sales and EBITDA. Well, the market has started to pick up, but I will not be excessively upbeat. And as our chairman said, we really have to keep our feet deeply grounded. Then we have our head of European and American sales, and I think that he is probably the most the key man in order to achieve the targets which we have set for ourselves. Well, what you said to start with, in my opinion, is absolutely true. In Europe, and we're looking January, February, we have seen a market which is up 8%. And as far as Italy is concerned, in the first 2 months, probably there has been a shift between the number of newly registered vehicles from scooters to bikes. That to say, bikes has probably have seen an increase in their relative weight of 5%. That's based on figures. That to say, other manufacturers have a kind of self-registered several bikes for quite ordinary reasons. So in other words, the market is up 8% with a shift towards bikes that have a greater weight. We're talking about 24-25%. And we're basically on a flat against last year as for scooters numbers. If we look at March instead, signals are quite interesting. In March, we have seen what we think is a sort of a consolidation of the market upward trend. Scooters are recovering part of the lost turf, growing 16% compared to the same period last year. And this is also very, very important for us. And I think that this is a good signal. On the other hand, bikes are growing, although at just 6%, so at a lower rate. So in March, we have seen an increase of 10%. And if you put that together with the numbers of January and February, you will get to an 8 or even 9% growth rate at the end of the first 3 months, with quite a massive recovery of the scooter segments, which brings market trends or sales trends back to normal. That's applicable to Italy as well. In the first few months, we saw quite shifting bikes and instead a rebalancing or trend reversal or rebalancing trend in March. So I think that Italy basically will still go on along these positive trend, although to a more moderate or contained rate compared to the rest of Europe. Let me mention Spain, which is a positive. Spain probably saw a total stop in selling and producing new bikes, and then in March we saw up an increase of 30%, and France also was up. Please consider that France is one of our key markets. So I would say that overall we're talking about an overall 9% market increase.
Marketing.
Before I hand it over to David as to marketing capex and investment, I would say that Moto Guzzi and Vespa are the two brands that are going to be more focused upon within the group, more core. But let's not forget Aprilia and bikes. We see at the end of the plan about 50,000 of them units. It's going to be a mix of bikes, like the ones you see here, and smaller bikes as well that we're producing for emerging markets. And Moto Guzzi will account for about one-third of those 50,000 units. Vespa, there'll be a lot of them because, of course, there are a lot of them in India. And then we'll see what it's going to be like for the second scooter product. Exception made for India, in excess of 200,000. 188,000 was the figure for this year. So the figures you see today are the same plus extra units for India. Davide, how much money am I going to get for marketing? Depends. The more you give me, the better, was the answer. Our marketing plan is as follows. So it's going to have fixed and variable costs. First of all, the fixed cost, it will be to build our positioning, the positioning of our brands, and to build our digital platform. We have the ambition to become the most or best digitalized bike and scooter manufacturer worldwide. This is our ambition. And we also want to lay the foundation for our retail project. The variable component is the expansion of the retail project. We are going to talk about 12 core markets where we're going to start. We're going to open flagship stores, multi-brand flagship stores in many cities in the world, and we will be following a roadmap that will be based on a number of conditions, market conditions on one hand, but also weather conditions, and also physical time frame, meaning the physical time required to build the network. So the investment could be between 80 and 100 million, depending on the speed at which we will be able to develop the retail network.
Sì, buon pomeriggio, Nicolo Storer, Mediobanca. Avrei qualche domanda.
Nicolo Storer with Mediobanca. If we look at the 2017 targets, which you have released, 215 million euro EBITDA and OPEX up 30 million, roughly speaking, that would imply quite a material decline in gross margin. Is that a fair assumption? And if so, what drivers might drive the gross margin down? Then I have a second question about India. It's a question about three-wheelers. How did you react to the reduction in the temporary decline in taxes applicable on durables? Have you given any rebates? Have you reduced or scaled down your prices? What has been the response or the sense of competitors as the market become more buoyant as a consequence of that? And then a final question about Vietnam. The plan to reduce the two-wheelers circulating fleet starting 2020 as demanded by the local government. We have heard sources mention, for instance, a ban on accessing by motor vehicles downtown areas and using instead the bicycles. What can you share with us? What have you been seeing? Well, 250 million euro EBITDA, probably I explain myself in an insufficient manner. The 100 million euro increase in gross margin is broken down as follows. 65% increase in sales. They are up 500 million euro, and out of that, approximately 65 million. Sorry, and the sales to EBITDA conversion gives us a 65 million euro. Then we have D&A, and then 30 million euro, which is efficiency gains on OPEX. That is to say, if everything would go up, obviously our OPEX level would reach an X, a level of X. Now, if we do some number crunching considering overheads as well as variables and scale efficiencies, then we expect a growth rate which is X minus 30, so no impact on gross margin. Gross margin remains in the range of 30%. So if you are below 30% in the industry, you are a bad performer. Then I have a second question on the Indian market. So there was a 4% reduction in taxes. There are outright taxes, just like registration tax and so on and so forth. So we have simply split it with customers on a 50% basis. That is to say, a couple of percentage points, or 50%, were passed on to consumers, and the remaining 50%, so approximately two other percentage points, instead being absorbed by our margin. And that's basically what also our competitors have done there. As for your third question, well, clearly the fact that there might be regulatory bans, well, that's no good news. But let's not forget what we start from. We're talking about a total market for 3 million vehicles, and we're talking about 70,000 to 80,000 vehicles. So whenever that market is hit by any factor, we are in the best position to increase our market share on a unit basis. Things would be different instead if we had a 30 to 40% market share. Clearly, such regulatory measures or crackdown should not be there, preferably so. But we think that two-wheelers mobility, or the mobility that will be created by our specialists going forward, will but benefit from the different governments that will foster mobility based on four-wheelers. Just go to India and China and you will see it for yourself. What that implies in terms of traffic and waste of money and waste of time.
Sì, vado io. Alberto Villa, Intermonte.
Alberto Villa, Intermonte. Good afternoon to all of you. Thank you for the presentation. A bit different from what we are used to, and so makes it a bit harder for us to ask merely financial questions. Let me ask a more general question. If we look at the financial plan you presented today, how much of it was already factored in your 2017 figures? It's a new project you're launching, you're starting with Harvard, you're introducing novelties, but how much the models you presented, will they be, when are they going to be delivered? What is the time frame against the time frame you're providing? It looks like an inertial plan versus the actual marketing plan. I mean, the financial versus the actual marketing plan. Could you tell? Could you elaborate more on the new products and how many products you're going to launch? How many dealerships you're going to open by 2017? Yes, I'll start and then I'll hand it over to those who, the colleagues who are specifically dealing with the products. So the project to do with smart cities, based on a new urban architecture, it's something, 10, 20, 30 years down the line, so there may be components that are translated into practice. The PMP platform, Mr. Sacchi was mentioning before, but we're not talking about sales speed driven or overturned by these novelties we are mentioning. Indeed, there will be innovative components or innovations, but we're mainly referring to new products within the framework of a two-wheeler mobility that's somehow similar to what we are experienced with or aware of. There are some solutions for smart urban solutions to accelerate mobility, and there are products that could be extended to new geographies, Latin America, greater focus on Asian countries, rather than eroding new market shares in segments where we already have a franchise, but we are not yet 100% tapping our potential, and then bikes in the U.S., bikes in Europe. Sorry, but we cannot hear the questions unless they are asked into a mic. There is indeed something, but we try to be conservative in our plan. It's a plan that's focusing on areas where we want to differentiate risk, because we've seen how the economy's been doing over the last few years, so it's important to have a franchise over three continents and over the three different types of business, because one region may pick up pace, the other one may slow down. So no, we're not expecting 100 million euro from Latin America, euro's top line or sales from Latin America, or small bikes in Asia. We're not betting 100 million euro top line. So there are upside opportunities that we introduced in the plan as capex, as investments for products. But the results, the real impact, meaning cash generating impact, will go beyond the business plan scope time frame. So there's electric bikes, Latin America, Asia, but these are not the main drivers for our business plan indeed. When you are presenting, well, when you're presenting a business plan, maybe you look at the top line, you look at prices, you look at where you sell your products, when you sell them, how much you spend to manufacture those products, what's your overheads, and how many taxes you're paying, how much are you paying in taxes, that's it. This is what I was doing when I was studying as a general accountant. And then I entered a company. I joined a company, and they didn't have the double entry accounting standard. They had somehow a production or industry-based accounting standard. And yet they were making tons of money. But that money was actually being cashed in or accounted for on January the 1st of the following year to the accounting year. We started introducing industrial costs to that accounting method, and we started having problems rather than solutions, because industrial costs, somehow they should eliminate problems. They tell you you're losing money where you are supposed to be earning money, or vice versa. So this gentleman understood that he needed people, human resources, not just accounting standards, people who were capable of managing and understanding what we call general accounting or industrial or industry-based accounting or mere marketing activities. Somebody who could actually solve the problems generated by accounting and marketing. So we ended up understanding that there are good people and bad people, and in order to run and come up with a good plan, you need good people. But it was hard to find good people or capable people or skilled people, because you find one person or another, and then maybe they don't have the right skills, or they follow the guidelines that they had in their own industry. We are a complex company. We went through issues, but we've always made money. We managed to keep the financials under control. Today we've realized that we need new good people or capable people or skilled people, and we've set targets. I'm not going to show you the products we want to manufacture, but I can assure you that the products we want to manufacture, not only have we designed them, engineered them, we've made all the necessary calculations, they're all there, we have them in bikes, we have them in scooters, we have them in three-wheelers and in four-wheelers. Today, I cannot disclose those products, otherwise I would have been showing something that is still yet very confidential. So we've also set and determined which men or human resources or staff we need to change. And here again today, I cannot disclose it to you. I don't want to disclose it today. But rest assured that the figures that were disclosed to you today, meaning the sales, and I'm talking to a friend from Mediobanc, gross margin cannot decline, because if it goes below 30%, that product has to be authorized by myself. And there must be a very good reason for that product to have a gross margin below 30%. I have to have very good reason to authorize it if the gross margin is below 30%. And then the way we manage our sales and we compare that against costs, of course, sales are based on hopes, of course, expectations. You hope to sell things and products, but we have to be flexible enough and be in control and capable of cutting costs where sales do not meet our expectations. So those sales, of course, stem from market analysis, the market analysis that they run on a number of products that are not imaginary products. They are clearly designed. It's like having a clear snapshot in mind. We also have an agenda as to when to launch them. We have an agenda as to where to launch them, and we've decided at which price they will be launched. So what are the pros and cons of this approach? Should the market, and I'm particularly referring to Europe, should the market start picking up again, as we all expect the market to pick up again, this company will make a lot of money, endless money, because we are coming from a cost-cutting process. We've been redesigning and resizing, meaning downsizing our operating facilities as well. So an increase in the top line and increasing sales is going to be translated into real growth. And in order to seize that opportunity, we need the right people. We need people who, from today onwards, will be addressing this market with a different background, with a different mindset, because our mindset so far was mainly and merely linked with the idea of manufacturing, selling to national or European markets and then maybe Asian markets, and we have factories there. Over the last 7 years, we've opened factories and plants there, and we've learned a lot over those 7 years. And among those things, we've learned that human resources are paramount, are the primary factor to come to grips with. So this very plan, if I were a financial analyst, but I'm not a financial analyst, so I may be wrong in the way I ask my question, this, of course, entails a risk. The human resources Piaggio is now relying on, will they be capable of addressing a global market, a highly competitive market, coming up with such and such requests and requesting this kind of products? Will they be able to somehow deliver on that? Because the market is 52, 54 million vehicles that are sold worldwide. The geographical areas, the geographies are more or less identified. Products are already in the pipeline. We've already identified, selected them, decided upon them, and so we're about to launch them. So what we're still missing, what we were still missing, were the so-called new mindsets, new cultures, new approaches that are paramount to tackle the market going forward, the future market. That will be focusing on dealers, that will be focusing on products, and that will be focusing on three large areas, geographies, Europe and the US, Asia and South America, and Africa. These are the main geographies. So if you want to go to Africa, for instance, you can go there, you might very well go there, but who's going to be a CEO of your factory in Laos, for instance?
Because you can present a business plan envisaging the sale of 400,000 scooters in Africa, but you need to have the right people. And we haven't found people willing to move or be relocated to Laos, Africa. So maybe we are too demanding in our requirements, or we're not providing sufficient benefits. But the key point is that we must, let me rephrase it, but the key, we must have the fundamental resources in order to deploy and implement this business plan, and they are just human resources. Now, well, I will only share numbers with you in order to tell you exactly what's inside that. We're talking about vehicles that will be introduced between now and 2017. Some of them already unfolding their potential, but we are envisioning 12 new scooters models, 5 major restyling projects, and 2 electric vehicles. That's what we envisage in the area of scooters and mobility. When we look at motorbikes, we have 8 new models, 3 major restyling projects, and 9 new model versions. And then we will have like 7 major technical improvements. If we look at light commercial vehicles, 1 new model in 3 wheelers, 3 major restylings, and 2 model versions. On 4 wheelers, we have 1 new model, 2 major restylings, and 1 model version. So, and incidentally, and I'd like to tie back in with what our chairman said, obviously, we have these projects that are at the different stages of our manufacturing and distribution pipelines. These are numbers we're talking about, designing industrialization processes and so on and so forth. Now, on average, it takes 2 years or 2 years and a half for each model. Others maybe will take longer. So, all these being said, we need people with a certain background and a certain expertise. Well, my initial question was probably linked to the fact that probably your business plan envisaged more as kind of inertial growth. A reply was given off record. As far as cash generation is concerned, a decline in debt over the next 4 years, I think that debt will go down between 70 to 80 million euros. So I think that CapEx will be 100 million euro yearly. What are the capital management assumptions that you say, dividend payments or other initiatives underlying these numbers that you have shared? Well, we have shown them clearly. We have introduced 120, I think it's a million euro in change of equity, which means that we have this assumption that can be an option. And obviously the AGM will have to resolve that. So that amount will be devoted either to dividends or to buybacks. There are other accounting issues such as conversion reserves and the likes. So I would say that on the one hand, this does not imply too high payout ratios if correlated to the profit levels which we have mentioned, and which might be adjusted upward or downward going forward. As far as cash generation is capacity, obviously we can do something better in the era of working capital. As you probably heard this morning, there has actually been some working capital absorption in 2013 because of the shrinking business trends, and we have compensated that by generating 20 million euro. But I think that we feel comfortable about achieving this target also by improving our working capital.
Gabriela Gambarova.
Gabriela Gambarova from Banca Akros. I have a question on working capital. The fact, for instance, that in India you really stress export a lot more than the fact that you'll be looking for another 4 Vietnam-like countries in Southeast Asia. Has something changed in the environment? We're used to seeing cash-generating growth, at least in Vietnam.
Has something changed in the backdrop, or what are the assumptions, the underlying assumption you have made going forward? No, I would say definitely no. Luckily enough, the growth in Asia is over at negative working capital, although not on a like-for-like basis, but with different parameters in this case. Instead of paying suppliers at 90, 120 days, as it happens in Europe, suppliers are paid at 45 to 60 days, whilst instead of cashing in from customers at 60 days, as it happens in Europe, you cash in straight away. In India, at some moment in time, not this year, but we had some credit. We had to open some credit facilities, but in India, at some moment in time, they even paid in advance. You want API, you pay them on the 15th of the month, and they will be delivered to you instead of another customer. So all other countries are negative working capital countries. But the worsening of the working capital situation, although we are still in the negative field, as we witnessed this year, it's not due to the fact that we opened up new markets, but rather to the fact that it's a shrinking business, but we have 350 million of payables to suppliers and 100 million of receivables from customers. When you switch your business base from X to X divided by 2, of course, both of them are halved, but in one case you lose 180 million, and the other case you earn 50. So you still have a shrinking business, whilst if the business is improving, you go long, you're much longer in your receivable. India, is something changing? Do you assume that something will be changing? No, I would say no. There are some peculiar special features, for instance, in Latin America. Latin America, there's a credit crunch there. So we start delivering only after we get the money. So it's a matter of managing the game in the right way. There are people who paid in the money, and it took 1 week to get the money, then we ran the necessary check, we got to the 20th of the month, we loaded the goods in the container has been traveling for 40 days, got to the port, customs cleared, and eventually the Latin American importer, but it happens in Africa as well, they paid 75, 90 days before they actually got the goods. So we can speed the process up a bit, but financially, we are far, we're on a different planet almost, far from there.
Two other quick questions. What's the exchange rate that you have assumed? Well, we have assumed current exchange rate because these are the best estimates. So we cannot have any forward-looking estimate about the exchange rate of Indian rupee, but I can say that, and incidentally, we have already been sufficiently crippled by exchange rates rather than a few years ago. However, when it comes to our results and our performance, the impact of Forex is limited. We manufacture our goods in euro-denominated areas, and we sell it in U.S. dollar-denominated regions. We manufacture in Indian rupee-denominated plants, and we sell to Indian rupee-denominated markets. And as far as the export of three-wheelers, that's applicable to that, as well as for buyback of vehicles. So basically here in Italy we will buy vehicles by benefiting. If we're talking about the Vietnam market, then the currency is dong and it's pegged to the U.S. dollar. So we are very, very balanced. We were rather short in renminbi, and renminbi moved from 1.11 to 7.80, and obviously that was a kind of drag on our cost base. Well, renminbi is probably seeing a trend reversal. And in addition to this, we are really easing off the buyback from China because we have our own plans in Vietnam and India, I think you said. So if there is an appreciation of the Chinese renminbi, that will not be a big deal for us, but not even in the other sense. Final question about your CapEx, 400 million euro, roughly speaking. Have you assumed any unchanged production capacity, that's to say measured in 800,000 vehicles? Yes. In 2007, we manufacture 500,000 vehicles in Europe, but that was not at full capacity because vehicles maybe were different, but we had a capacity in the region of 1.7 million. In Europe, we saw 160,000 million pieces, and manufacturing capacity is fully in line. No problems in India for two-wheelers. We have a manufacturing capacity of 150,000. And for three-wheelers, I think you said 180,000. But there, we might be seeing certain bottlenecks, but we're talking about really minimal issues. And an opportunity might come, and it might be a banal example, but that's LATAM. Here we have started to sell, seeing reasonable margins, which means after you have paid 60 to after having paid export-import cost, so we're talking about 60 to 70%. Otherwise, you can small 2 million euro and have a small manufacturing plant, therefore cutting down the cost of products by 60%. So maybe you can also have price rebates. But if you do a little bit of number crunching, you can see opportunities. But obviously, we will check them on an individual case basis with a logical of ROE. But we're talking about minor projects. Sorry, ROI. However, this year, in 2013, says Mr. Colanino, we have embarked upon massive restructuring, and the manufacturing facilities which we have in Europe are still far away from having reached full capacity. They're not utilized at full capacity. Last year, we closed down our plant in Spain. We relocated it to Noale, and in Noale, we reduced the headcount based on our expected Aprilia vehicles. So we have already done quite some sizable restructuring, reaching a balance between given level of production capacity and the existing demand.
Buonasera, Nicola Rolando.
Nicola Rolando from Citigroup. I have three questions for you. First of all, on India, if I understand well, one of the pillars in your expansion policy is to push on the export of light commercial vehicles. I understand that it's a broad market, I mean the export market, but Bajaj has 80% of that market, and it's a main market for them. It's 50% of their volumes. So what comes to mind is that Bajaj is flexible as well as resilient. It has 2.5 times your volumes and 10 percentage point extra EBITDA margin versus you. What makes you think or so confident that you can actually penetrate this market? First question. Second question, always concerning India. What's your view, what's your take on four-wheelers? I understand it's still premature because they have not yet introduced into the market, but do you think and assume that that product could cannibalize, even though partly cannibalize, the three-wheeler? And then I have a question on the four Vietnam-like countries, how you can replicate the Vietnam strategy. Undoubtedly, you did achieve great success with Vespa in Vietnam. However, if you look at figures, when you take Vespa outside Vietnam, not always has it been as successful as it was there. India is an example. I realize it's a very different market indeed, plot. Let me, could you elaborate on that and try and make us understand whether that can be applied to other products that other than Vespa, I mean, or whether Vespa for price positioning purposes is the only product that can compete in those markets? Well, let's take one question at a time. Sorry, if I remember well, your first question was about whether you can compete against Bajaj. Well, let's say that historically Bajaj, they were better than we were. In 2004, we were looking at them from far away, from afar, so to say, and they started pushing. Not with the anxiety, they started competing and getting better. And for some time, we did not develop the right product, an ad hoc product versus the, it's a smaller vehicle than the API we were producing with different fuel systems, LPG, CNG. Last year, we did produce that kind of vehicle. So product-wise, we are on the same footing as Bajaj. We have a product today that is basically the same consumption-wise, even better because we came later, so we built a slightly more performing engine consumption-wise and very much in line with the scooter engines, but so I don't know whether we will be better than Bajaj. I can say that Bajaj has almost 90% market share to the present day. I say that worldwide there are a lot of opportunities. Bajaj is working with single mandate players, agencies, dealers, and where we are exporting instead, there are other entrepreneurs who are willing to do business. So there are people who will still selling Bajaj on a sole and exclusive basis, but there are other dealers who are willing to as well. So we just put 30,000 extra units, more than we are producing today. So we're being conservative there. There's some kind of discontinuity there, but we're not saying we're going to sell 50% of Bajaj's volume. What we put in is aggressive but feasible, we would say. And that was one of the questions. The last question you asked was about Vietnam, Vietnam business model and Vespa, and are we going to replicate that? No, the four-wheeler. So I don't remember the exact order in which the questions were asked. So four-wheeler, indeed, it's something that can enter the market, but we still have to fully have a full grasp of how it will be perceived and accepted. We don't know whether it will replace the three-wheeler, because from the point of view of mere mobility and from a mere functional viewpoint, APE used in cities today for freight transportation, it's one of the smartest vehicles human beings have ever conceived, so to say. It costs, well, it's very cheap and has three wheels. It can move safely also on grounds that some not so smooth, and you can swerve with a quite comfortable swerve radius, and it's not just a matter of offering a more stylish product or just adding an extra wheel. Having that type of vehicle with the same features, flexibility, APE can even be loaded more than a four-wheeler, so it very much depends on what Bajaj will do. We'll wait and see. They started with an experiment. They came up with a four-wheeler that's different from ours. Sorry, a comment was made, but not into a mic, so we could not hear the comment and therefore translate it. So from a technology viewpoint, the four-wheeler is not a game changer, it's not a breakthrough, it's something that technology-wise, well, should we realize that everybody wants a four-wheeler and nobody wants a three-wheeler anymore, exception made for the countries where we are strong, for the markets where we are strong, this is something we can replicate that in the short term. Vietnam-like countries, Asian 5 has nothing to do with India. India is a standalone market with its own distinctive and specific features, just like China. ASEAN 5 is a market where customers are a lot more aspirational versus the Indian customers, and there's a greater will and availability to spend some more money to pay a premium also for a mobility vehicle, such as a scooter. So this happened in Vietnam because Piaggio, 10 years ago, started to introduce the Vespa, little by little. Other countries, we've been focusing on them for 4 or 5 years now. So they're making up their mind somehow. Thailand, for instance, now they have political problems now. But in Thailand, Vespa is very much like what Vespa was like in Vietnam from the point of view of being an aspirational product. So I don't see major problems in distributing and having a growing distribution of it. So I don't see major issues on these four countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand. Taiwan is a bit different still. In achieving something that's similar, I'm not talking 200,000 units. Vietnam, in the old days, so to say, 30,000 units per country. This is what I mean by Vietnam-like development.
Well, during our presentation, we said that we want to have worldwide products, but also with a specific focus on Asian market needs. So if on the one hand, the Vespa is kind of a stepping stone for us, because there is a very strong sub-layer of brand awareness. So Vespa is known and appreciated worldwide, and it also expresses intangible values. But if we look at the other segments of our product range, we're talking about products that stay as that retain their premium positioning, but they can cover very specific markets. For instance, these, unlike Vespa, they have big wheels rather than small wheels. How do you plan to position them price-wise? What is the price positioning going to be? Because this is my fear. Vespa is quite a unique product. When you're talking about Liberty or other products, then the price premium can be a deterrent, preventing customers from buying. Well, on Liberty, we have quite an exhaustive experience, quite a track record, which is represented by Vietnam in the past 3 years. Well, I would say that 65 million of Vietnamese dong, that's the equivalent amount of sold Vespas, and that's quite a different number for Liberty. So margins are different compared from Vespas because the cost of product is not so different, but we're talking about something which has a four in front or up front. So whether to maintain a 4% as the first digit of the margin, well, that's still to be seen, but we would like a 3. Thank you very much, says Mr. Colanino, and see you next year. Obviously, if you have additional questions, you can contact either our IR, Mr. Lupotto, or myself. Thank you very much.